Whatever exists in this world is the property of the Brahmana. On account of the excellence of his origin, the Brahmana is indeed entitled to it all. The Brahmana eats but his own food, wears but his own apparel, bestows but his own in alms. Other mortals subsist through the benevolence of the Brahmanas. In order to clearly settle his duties and those of the other castes, according to their order, is that a half-dead buffalo?
Somebody found the old conch in the box.
Oh, okay. And they're trying to blow it. Okay. In order to clearly settle his duties and those of the other castes according to their order, wise Manu sprung from the self-effulgent, composed these institutes of the sacred law. So here is that Lord Brahma, who's come from Krishna, then to establish very clearly what everybody should do, then he has composed these, you know. He learned it from Krishna, and now he's composed it and spoken it here. So in other words, the Veda deals with everything, but then he's extracted from that, and then given this. 103, a learned Brahmana must carefully study them and must duly instruct his pupils in them, but nobody else shall do it. In other words, these should be learned by a Brahman and taught by a Brahman. Others should not teach them. Because otherwise, you see, what may happen is the tendency is to use it according to one's own purposes. Mm-hmm. Like the manager will use, just like you see, we have what's called istagosti, right? Mm-hmm. So istagosti means we come together to discuss topics of the Lord, which would generally means it'll be philosophically based, shastrically based. You know, they'll be discussing the philosophy, discussing its application in the culture and all that. And then there's also some practical, there would be practical applications in a particular circumstance, mm-hmm. like that. But what we see happens much of the time is istagosti simply means that the temple leaders call together the devotees to tell them what are the temple rules. Mm-hmm. There's no a real discussion of philosophy or why mm-hmm. that rule has come into place. It simply mm-hmm. uses a managerial forum, mm-hmm. bus. To the point where no one's interested in istagosti. You have seminars, you have this, you don't hear of anybody being interested in istagosti, right? But istagosti mm-hmm. means the devotees come together and discuss, like that. Mm-hmm. So that's our original form, is it's like workshop. There's some presentation and there's questions on it, discussions on it, or, you know, it's more informal, mm-hmm. informal, you know, how you say, informal, but according to etiquette, like that.
It's like in Chaupari, every day, the Brahmacharis have that discussion.
They have every day. At what time?
After breakfast.
After breakfast.
They sit together, and somebody will, like if they're reading their devotion, they'll read a few paragraphs, and then one of the Brahmacharis will give his realization on that, and then everyone just discusses their realizations and their buildings.
How to apply it and everything like that.
And that goes for a couple of hours every day.
Oh, so that's the noon class. Okay.
That's how they do the class.
I see. It's like that.
Open general discussion. Okay. And they really go through it. It's a really good class. Really good way of
Very nice.
Learning.
Very nice.
And then when they exhaust the point, and they read a little bit more.
More.
And they
discuss again. Yeah. So they may spend the whole time on one little bit, or they may go through many things. Sometimes even a few days. Oh, even if the discussion doesn't stop, then they'll continue the next day. Yeah. That's the best.
So the next day they'll come back, and you know somebody will be. Yesterday we read this. This is my, and then he'll make a whole presentation.
Oh, he got some more realization from it. Oh, so they can continue with what they realization they got. Oh, that's very good. Yeah. Very good.
And you understand? Really go through
the first part.
He was saying that in Chaupati, because we brought up the point of istagosti, because it says a learned Brahman must carefully study them and he must duly instruct his disciples in them, but nobody else shall do it. Because the tendency is the Kshatriya in describing Dharma Shastra will just describe it from the point of law and order. He wants to establish discipline, and so he may present it like that. The Vaishya may present it according to what's beneficial for his you know, profit. Yeah. And the Vaishya the Shudra may present it according to how you say? You know, his art or his, you know, accommodate his philosophy, you know, because all artists have, like Picasso or Salvador Dali, they all have their philosophy, you know, like that. But, so.
It's like one of our leaders that just left ISKCON. He's got a whole new philosophy, and he backs it all up with Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, but he himself said that he was a Kshatriya, not a Brahmin. So therefore...
But his philosophy is like a...
Yeah, that's another thing. we won't get into that. We'll not get into the philosophy. Aforesaid unnamed person. So the Brahmana. So he was pointing out that in Chaupati, then they'll sit in some points, like if they're reading Nectar Devotion, a few paragraphs, you know, enough to make a point, will be there, and then somebody will say something on it, and then everyone will start giving their realization and discussing it. And if they finish the discussion, then they go on to the next point. If they don't, then it takes the whole class, and if it may even go to the next day. Like the next day, they may start off, someone has a realization on that, then they'll continue. So that's a good point. We should have something like that. Yeah. Okay. Now this doesn't mean that, you know, the mother is not instructing the child in, you know, this is proper behavior and etiquette and like that. That kind of informal instruction, just what you know you're giving to someone else. But in other words, sitting and studying the text, where then you could say, yes, you know I've learned from this person. That only the Brahmin should do. Otherwise, in the family or in elders of the community, within the community, they may teach just the practical application, but the whole science behind it, that should be done by the Brahmins, because they're considered, they're supposed to be, if they're properly trained, neutral. You know, they don't have any, they have no purpose to fulfill, but see that the law is, you know, that the Shastra is maintained. You know, according to, you know, Guru and Sadhu. A Brahmana who studies these institutes and faithfully fulfills the duties prescribed therein is never tainted by sins arising from thoughts, words, or deeds. So then, if one always is practicing, this is the point Krishna mentions in the Gita, is that even if somebody does something that's not proper, if he's properly situated, then he is not tainted by the sin, because that will be overcome by a good act. As we see that Drona's son, Ashwatthama, and he committed very terrible activities that even a Kshatriya wouldn't perform, let alone a Brahmin. But because he continued his proper sadhana and everything, and after, you know, proper correction and all that, means he was to wander around in the forest for 3,000 years and always smelling, you know, the smells of stool and urine and, you know, things that, you know, annoy Brahmins. You know, and then after that he'd be freed from that, and then he'll be the next Vyasadeva. So it's because of proper performance, then these things are cleared like that. So if he always studies these and always practices them, then these other things are not going to... One is there's going to be a tendency not to do any of that stuff, but if by accident or bad habit it happens, then still that will be, one will be able to overcome that. So we understand, it's very important to understand as you go through that these things where they say they'll reach the highest goal, you know, they'll be uncontaminated, this is specifically talking about the devotee. Because only the devotee really understands, because he says here, means who studies and faithfully fulfills his duties prescribed therein. Actually, only the devotee is faithfully fulfilling and fully understanding what he studies. You know, that's why it's said is that we have the path in the Vedas of the Gyan. You know, but actually only the devotees can follow it. Because a jnani actually doesn't have full knowledge. His knowledge is incomplete. It's still material. You know, as described in the Bhagavatam yesterday. Prabhupada said that the concept of Brahman realization and Paramatma realization is slightly materially tinged, because they manifest after the material world manifest. You don't have those concepts in the spiritual realm. Krishna is outside.
Honey.
Whereas I don't think we need. Do we? We don't buy honey.
Lagvana.
No, I can't Lagvana. Cable to you, okay. I don't know. Preeti sir? He wants it then. I can't Lagvana. Amara Achi. So then, in the spiritual realm, you're serving the Lord directly. Mm-hmm. You know, He's there in front of you. It's only when we come to the material world, He has to enter the heart to come with us. Mm-hmm. He's out of His own desire. Mm-hmm. And the understanding of Brahman, just on its own as Brahman, you'd only get that outside the planets. Because in the planets, in the spiritual planets, they're there with the Lord. The Lord's effulgence is there, but you don't think of it in terms of Brahman. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just His effulgence. He's very effulgent, very bright. Mm-hmm. But on its own, standing without the personal form of the Lord, you'll only find that concept in the material world. Mm-hmm. So they're not complete. So actually, only the devotee can follow the path of karma, jnana, and yoga properly, because it's in connection with Krishna. That's the actual purpose of it. Karma means all your activities are for Krishna, mm-hmm. His satisfaction. Jnana means all of your knowledge is about Krishna. You know, and how the material world connects with Krishna, the process of devotional service, who Krishna is, who we are, all this. And yoga, all our meditation, and all of our absorption in the mantra, that is all in connection with Krishna. So actually only the devotee. So we have to understand here, when it says these things, this means a devotee, like that. Hmm? Is that clear? 105. He sanctifies any company which he may enter, seven ancestors and seven descendants, and he alone deserves to possess this whole earth. To study this work is the best means of securing welfare. It increases understanding. Means the health and welfare would do wise to take. It increases understanding. It procures fame and long life. It leads to supreme bliss. So supreme bliss, the only supreme bliss is actually Krishna consciousness. So it leads to, means it's a sub aspect. It's just like you can say cutting vegetables leads to cooking. Mm-hmm. You know? So for the conditioned soul, you know, who has, you know, a whole, you know, cauliflower, it needs to be cut and prepared, then only you can cook. Someone on the Brahman platform, the Brahma Bhuta platform, you know, everything's already in the pot, you know. I mean, there is no preparation. There is no material conception. But for conditioned soul, then he needs to follow it, and that leads to pure and alloyed devotional service. So it must be understood how to. Then 107. In this work, the sacred law has been fully stated, as well as the good and bad qualities of human actions, and the immemorial rule of conduct to be followed by all the four varnas. So here, what's good, what's bad, and what is what everybody is supposed to perform? $700 what? That was a $700 what? Clue, she said. She came to talk to Preeti, so probably. She was saying that if she was in America, that would have cost him $700. The rule of conduct is transcendent law, whether it be taught in the revealed script text or in the sacred tradition. It's interesting, the sacred tradition. Mm. Because it means, in other words, it's come down, someone's realized it, and speaking according to it and giving that. Hence, a twice-born man who possesses regard for himself should always be careful to follow it. In other words, if the person has any self-esteem or any dignity, then he'll follow it. If he doesn't have dignity, then he can say whatever he like. He can talk about three regulative principles, three and a half, three and three quarters, three and a quarter. I mean, you can say whatever you want, but if you have any self-dignity, then you have to follow it. You know, a brahmana who departs from the rule of conduct does not reap the fruit of the Vedas, but he who duly follows it will obtain the full reward. Because the full reward is pure and alloyed devotional service. So if following the etiquette, then the behavior with people is better. The sacred law has come from Krishna. So this is how Krishna expects the humans to act. When he comes, he acts according to it. So now, out of that broad body of rules that Krishna gives, then the acharyas pick those which are specific for our purpose. Like Ramanuja will pick a slightly different body, you know, the broadness of the body or the emphasis of the body than what our acharyas will pick. because they're trying to go to Vaikuntha, like that. We're trying, and those the you know, Shankara will pick another slightly different, because they're trying to get to the Brahman. But our acharyas will pick a certain, because we're getting into Golok Vrindavan, into Braj Vrindavan. So those are the rules. It's just like you have a huge amount of tools, and you have a particular work, you'll pick those tools, but it's from the same body of tools. So you see commonality, you know, respect and cleanliness, all these are common, but just where the emphasis is and how detailed you get into a particular aspect, that will vary. So our acharyas have picked, we have to accept it. We can't say, well, that's for another time, or, you know, time, play, you know, it doesn't apply to us as Westerners, all this. This means we don't understand what is the sacred law. You know, like that. I mean, we're Westerners, so we can't clean our backside, you know, with our left hand. We have to use the right hand, or, you know, we're, you know, we use either hand as we like, or like that. You know, it means they just apply. We still, you know, as in West, you can still eat with your right hand. You know, you can still do what we do. It's just a matter of if we want to, if the mind wishes to accept it or not. So the full reward comes by following what the acharyas give us.
Krishna says the mind is controlled through practice and detachment.
So that comes from intelligence. And that comes from the ego accepting that I am servant. That's it. Control by practice and
detachment.
Practice and detachment. That's nice. Practice and attachment. So worthy principles.
Because you're saying to follow the rules.
Yeah.
So you got to practice following the rules, and you got to be detached to your own materialistic culture.
Yeah. Very good. You understand all these things? Sure. Yeah.
She said she has to study more.
Okay, but you. Okay, but otherwise you get the main point. Okay. The sages who saw that the sacred law is thus grounded on the rule of conduct have taken good conduct to be the most excellent root of all austerity. Okay, so then the law is grounded on the application of good behavior, and then have taken good conduct to be the root of austerity. So if you want to be austere, you have to have good conduct. Otherwise, we see Hiranyakashipu was very austere, but because it wasn't grounded on good conduct, there was no benefit in his austerity. It just gave everyone problem. Shruti Smriti Puranadi. Is it? Pancharatra Vidhim Vina means it's without, according to the rules of these scriptures, then it's useless. And it doesn't give rise to devotion. The creation of the universe, the rule of the sacraments, the ordinances of studentship, and the respectful behavior towards gurus, the most excellent rule of bathing on return from the teacher's house, that means the graduation.
Why is that so important?
Which?
The most excellent rule of bathing on return from the teacher's house.
Because that is the, how do you say? Because then, as the brahmacharya has taken shelter of the various rules of brahmacharya, and the various how do you say rituals that go with it, then he has completed those vows. So that means shows the determination and everything like that, and pleasing of the guru, and then the. That's right. You can go through Sambhartan now. Because Sambhartan is only there for those who get married. We should do that while you. So then and he's snataka, he's bathed. So then he's purified by water, he's purified by understanding. I'm sure all these things, if you get right into it, they're very, very deep, though the scriptures don't talk that much about it. It means they give hint here and there, but not all necessarily in one place. In other words, all the aspects of the brahmachari, they transform into another aspect that he will use in just mm-hmm. his movement in the world, mm-hmm. you know, like that. So he gets the same protections, but it's through a different medium. Mm-hmm. So he's then in that way he establishes self for his life. I'm returning from the teacher's house. The law of marriage is going through, and the description of the various marriage rites, the regulations for the great sacrifices, and the eternal rule of the funeral sacrifice. The description of the modes of gaining subsistence, and the duties of a snataka, means the one who has bathed, means that Brahmin who has bathed and graduated. The rules regarding lawful and forbidden food, the purification of men and of things. The laws concerning women, the law of hermits, the manner of gaining final emancipation and of renouncing the world, the whole duty of a king and the manner of deciding lawsuits, the rules for the examination of witnesses, the laws concerning husband and wife, the law of inheritance and division, the law concerning gambling, the removal of men noxious like thorns, the law concerning the behavior of Vaishyas and Shudras, the origin of the mixed castes, the law for all castes in times of distress, and the law of penances. The threefold course of transmigrations, the result of good or bad actions, the manner of attaining supreme bliss, and the examination of the good and bad qualities of actions. The primeval laws of countries, of castes, of families, and the rules concerning heretics and companies of traders and the likes. All that Manu has declared in these institutes. As Manu, in reply to my questions, formally promulgated these institutes, even so, learn ye also the whole work from me. So now this is what he's going to describe now, mm-hmm. all that. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, as he questioned Manu and got the answers, says, now you hear from me and you can question me. I'm not sure if it's in here. There's something here that comes back. Chapter 2. Learn that sacred law, which is followed by men learned in the Veda, and ascended to in their hearts by the virtuous who are ever exempt from hatred and inordinate affection. Okay, here's one here. It's followed by men learned in the Veda and who ascended to it in their hearts. Means there's realization. They take it as value. Mm-hmm. Like that. They take it that this is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. Like that. So this is that level, is they know it, they follow it, and then they realize it. So this is important. So those who have the realization, then they take it. By the virtues who are ever exempt from hatred and inordinate affection. Means they hate no one, and they don't materially have affection for someone. Mm-hmm. Like that. So they're equal. So these persons, they follow this law. Mm-hmm. If there's too much hatred or too much mundane affection, the tendency is to want to not follow the law. Mm-hmm. Because then if I hate somebody, I want to do harm to him, but the law says I shouldn't. And if I love somebody so much, I want to do so many things that the law says I shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So those who are balanced, they can actually follow the law. So it's a matter of one should try to purify one's existence, then the law has more meaning. To act solely from a desire for rewards is not laudable, yet an exemption from that desire is not to be found in this world. For on that desire is grounded the study of the Veda and the performance of the actions described by the Veda. In other words, means it's not, if one is, in other words, one wants, the idea that one wants just fruit. He's doing something because he gets this result, and that's it. That's not considered very glorious. Right? But at the same time, it says, exemption from that desire is not to be found in this world. Transcendental world, yes, but in this world, no. Mm-hmm. But here is even the spiritual world, they want to please Krishna. So an activity always has a desire behind it, and there's a fruit that you want to get. Mm-hmm. But the problem comes is if that fruit is simply self-centered, that is not considered good. Mm-hmm. So the point is you want to, the desire for something is there. That's why someone will endeavor even in spiritual life, because he wants to, in the beginning, be freed from the anxiety of the material world, right? He was freed from, you know, no wealth, you know, artarti, anxiety, the arta. He's looking for knowledge, the what's it? The jigyasu, like this. So these desires are there. But with time, then it comes that then the desire changes. You want to please Guru, Krishna, the Vaishnavas. Then you know that's your duty. But in the beginning, these following of these rules. So the following the rules establish the practice, you know, especially on the neophyte platform. Those generally, by the time one gets to the Madhyam platform, one is practiced. Mm-hmm. Like that. One is practiced. Mm-hmm. So then one follows them, but one is not following because of that. One is following, how you say? One is following for higher purposes. In other words, because there's desire, there's action. So now it's a matter of whether it's material or spiritual. You know? So here, if we see it, if we're following them because of the material fruit, that's not considered so good. But we're following because this is Krishna's law. Mm-hmm. And we want to please him by following. So therefore we have to follow in the mood he's given us through the acharyas. Mm-hmm. Therefore we can't be overly, if we overly take it, that's niyamagraha. Or if we reject it, that's niyamagraha. So that the proper balance must be, that's why it said before, Brahman must study it, he must teach it. Because then you'll be delivered, you know, ideally from the platform of goodness, of pure goodness. While the others might tinge it with passion, ignorance, like that. Then the balance will not be proper. 3. The desire for rewards indeed has its root in the conception that an act can yield them, and in consequence of that conception, sacrifices are performed. Vows and the laws prescribing restraints are all stated to be kept through the idea that they will bear fruit. Yeah, so that it means the desire for the reward is there in the idea I do an activity gives me the result. Right? So in the beginning the lower level is I think, okay, I'm doing this austerity or this restraint and that will give me, I will therefore gain that result. But as we go, we find that as we become more mature, we understand that actually that's not what's happening. Because Krishna is the doer. I mean, Krishna is the one who is sanctioning it in the modes of nature, doing it and delivering it. So we're not actually doing. We can desire, and then Krishna sanctions the modes of nature to deliver. So basically it comes back to just desire. But if that's there in the beginning, it's very hard to understand. So in the beginning, one does because they think, I am doing this. You know, I am fasting on Ekadasi. But actually, what's happening is, I desire to fast on Ekadasi. Krishna sanctioned that in the modes of nature. Then arrange that we don't become disturbed. Like that. So that's what's going on. You know, so then, that desire. So ultimately, then we come to our desires to please Krishna. And since Krishna has given these, then we follow. You know, it's this culture. One has to follow a culture to interact with others. So this is culture. Like that. Spiritual world, that culture is based on rasa. So the rasa controls. The controlling feature there is rasa. So in the material world, the concept of rasa is either misunderstood, misused, or not understood at all. You know? So then, even though all the rules, everything goes back to rasa, it has its foundation in the spiritual realm. And then that comes through and may come in a very... Its reflection may be pleasant, you know, and beneficial for spiritual life, or maybe pleasant and avoided, or maybe even not very pleasant. You know, as we see, as Krishna transforms into Shiva, and then from, you know, the pure form of Sadashiva into Shambhu, and then into, like, you know, Kalabhairava, and all these other very kind of like very transformed mentalities, you know, where you have him and his wife, you know, his wife's got her own head cut off, and the blood is spurting out, and she's catching it in the cup, and, you know, running around with no clothes on, and all this kind of stuff. Then, you know, these things happen in the material world, so they come from that really, we understand as we're taking those things that are beneficial that take us back to the spiritual realm. For not a single act here below appears ever to be done by a man free from desire. For whatever man does, it is the result of the impulse of desire. Right? So it's a matter, you just change your desire from material to spiritual. That's the real thing. That's what Arjuna, Krishna was telling Arjuna. You just change your desire. You're performing your prescribed duties. You don't have to give them up. You have to give up the desire for the fruit of that. That's all. And to do that and dedicate that to Krishna. That's all. That's all he's asking. So, therefore, the prescribed duties should be understood. You know, what is the body of prescribed duties? Mm-hmm. Like that. He who persists in just discharging these prescribed duties in the right manner teaches the deathless, or reaches the deathless state, and even in this life obtains the fulfillment of all the desires he may have conceived. So the deathless state means you go back to the spiritual world. There is no such deathless. They use these terms like this because for the karmi, deathless is the heavenly planets, because they're amara, deathless, because no one dies on the heavenly planet. They die off the while falling in the space between the heavenly planet and the earth. But to them, that's deathless. For the jnani, then he obtains the Brahman, that's deathless. You know, for the yogi merging in the Lord, then that's deathless. But we actually understand what it actually means. Deathless means entering the spiritual world and taking up relationship with Krishna, acting in that rasa. You know, so you'll find that in here, all these kind of words are written in just to motivate everybody. You know, even for the gross materialist who doesn't even know about heaven and planets, he may become intus because he doesn't want to die. So even he may think, okay, I'll follow him, even though I don't believe in any of this. But if this will make me deathless, then, you know. So he has, there must be some motive.
It's like the first few chapters of the Gita. Krishna speaks in such terms as could be applicable to karmas, yogis.
Yeah, anybody. It's interesting.
And bhaktis.
And bhaktis. Yeah, same thing.
Chapter 4, he changes things.
Changes in the moods and more.
Transcendental knowledge.
It's interesting that the acharyas, I think, I'm not sure it's Vishnu, he points out, either that or Krishna is pointing out, that this nishkam karma yoga, even just a materialist, a non-devotee can follow and become purified and brought to the Brahma Buddha platform. Yeah. You know, he's saying theoretically, but he says generally only a devotee can follow it, therefore it doesn't happen. But the theory is even you're not a devotee, you can follow nishkam karma yoga and you'll be benefited. You'll be brought to the Brahma Buddha platform. All material desires will be removed. You know, it's such a good system. It's good for everybody, you know. Okay. The whole Veda is the first source of the sacred law. Next, the tradition and the virtuous conduct of those who know the Veda further. Also, the customs of holy men. And finally, self-satisfaction. So the whole that means the scriptures. These are the whole means from the scripture is the first source. Means in other words, the scriptures themselves are the first source of this knowledge, this sacred law. Then you have the tradition. Means just what's been handing down generation to generation, how they follow. The Gaudiyas, they do this. This is called Shishtachar. means shishta, is the remnants from the others. So the remnants that we've gained from the advanced persons before us, that shishtachara, just we as Gaudiyas always do this. We wear our neck beads like this, you know, we wear our tilak like this. It's shishtachara. Mm-hmm. You know, the scripture doesn't necessarily exactly say it's got to be just like this. That sometimes devotees don't understand, but the shastra says that is bona fide, mm-hmm. You know, like that.
You always ask for the verse.
Yeah.
Don't put your big toe in your mouth.
Yeah. Well, no, there is a shloka that says Krishna puts his big toe in your mouth, mm. And he rides on a banyan leaf on the waters of destruction. Mm. So that's the only verse that talks about putting your big toe in your mouth. So therefore, you can do it. It's bona fide as long as you can ride on a banyan leaf on the waters of destruction. You know, and it has to be your own toe. It can't be someone else's. I don't know if anyone told this to Govinda Maharaj.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, then the virtuous conduct of those who know the Veda. Okay, so those who we know, their conduct, who know the Veda, how they behave. In other words, they have studied it. They have seen according to tradition, and they apply it in their life. We can take that. In other words, their example. This is the meaning of acharya. Means by they teach by example. Then, that of the holy men. Customs of holy men. So we read so many, you know, in the Bhagavatam, and we hear in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and so many of the histories, how all the different saintly persons that they would behave, you know, other than what we know, you know, like that. And then finally, self-satisfaction. This is a very important thing to understand, because this will come up a little bit later. This self-satisfaction means that there are laws for the Brahmin, laws for the Kshatriya, laws for the Vaishya, laws for the Shudra, laws for the Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyas. So now you have to be satisfied in following the law. Means the law is there, you take one body of it, if you're satisfied in it, that's where you belong. If you're not satisfied, then you have to see where the dissatisfaction is, and then find which of the varna and ashram fulfills that dissatisfaction. Mm-hmm. Like that. But if one finds that one is not satisfied in any of the four varnas or ashrams, one, either we didn't follow it properly, or two, we belong in the jungle. Mm-hmm. You know? Like that. So it's like that self-satisfaction must be there, not that what makes me satisfied, I create the rules. No, I adjust myself within the rules till I find that situation that's actually satisfying. Mm-hmm. Like that. You know? That's very important. It goes the other way. You know? It's objective, not subjective. You test it. That's the thing. The Vedas, it's just like the Shastras is this material world full of birth, death, old age, and disease. So we hear the theory, but it actually becomes substance to us when we can go out into the material world and we see, here is birth, here is death, old age, and we see, yes, that's what's going on. Like that. Then when we realize that, and we act accordingly, maybe I go out and I see it. So that's the next stage, means the shabda has become pratyaksha. Mm. Means what I see through the senses, I perceive what the shabda is talking about. Mm-hmm. But it must start from shabda. It can't start from pratyaksha, and then I try to screw it out of shabda. Mm-hmm. No, shabda says this place is birth. What is it? Mityalok. So then I see, it is there. Then when I realize it, I'll act according to that. I may see, yes, birth, death, old age, and disease. So therefore, you know, be merry because tomorrow we die. That means we've noticed it, but we haven't realized it. When we realize it, then we know, no more of this stuff. And now I get serious about Krishna consciousness, like Maharaj Pariksit. He realized. So therefore, he sat down, and in 7 days, he heard the Bhagavatam. Like that. So that's whatever law has been ordained for any person by Manu, that has been fully declared in the Veda, for that sage was omniscient. In other words, there's laws for everybody because Manu is omniscient. One of the qualities, Brahma, is omniscient. You know, to some degree, not like Krishna, but it's like the living entity has 50 qualities of Krishna, and Brahma and Shiva, those the next five. They have in part all Vishnu has in full. And then from 55 to 60, then Vishnu has in Vishnu has in part, and Mahanarayana has in full. And then from 60 to 64, that only Krishna has. So that aspect of omniscience, then Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva have. So he's pointing out here is that Manu already worked it out. He even considered all these things, taking into view the Americans. Is that he was omniscient, and so he could foresee that there was going to be a species called Americans. And he actually made rules that could be applied to them. Like that. In other words, it does fit. One just has to know the art of applying it. You know, that would be like saying that, you know, let's say a car can only work in America, it won't work in Canada or something like that. You just have to know how to do it. You know, you take the same car and you go to England, and then you drive in the same way as America. There may be problems since they drive on the opposite side of the street. Mm-hmm. So you just have to know how to apply it. Okay, it means in this situation I use it this way, in that situation I use it that way. But there's still the same principles. You know, I'm going to push on the gas, it goes forward, I push on the brake, it stops, and I turn the little key, it starts, and, you know, and I turn the little wheel and it moves left and right, and stuff like that. So those always remain. So the principles remain, just some of the details may adjust. But a learned man, after fully scrutinizing all this with the eye of knowledge, should, in accordance with the authority of the revealed text, be intent on the performance of his duties. So he studies it, and then he sees through that, and he applies that. Does that make any sense? So in accordance with the authority of the revealed text, he should be intent on following it. Right? In other words, according to the Shastra, that is where he gets his evidence on how he should act. You know? Like if it says one should be humbler than a blade of grass, more tolerant than a tree, you know, offer all respect to others, not expect respect for oneself, then one knows that this is proper behavior, not, you know, some other idea. Okay, let's say in the modern culture, that's not the idea. You know, you have to look cool and be tough and, you know, have that, you know, don't mess with me look and all that kind of thing. But we understand, okay, we may put on that look as we walk down the street so no one bothers us, but that's not actually our mood. Mm-hmm. You know, our actual mood is we're humble, we're tolerant. Mm-hmm. We offer respect to others in that. Because even in that, if you're respectful and nice with people, they'll appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Even the roughest person, you know, expects to be dealt with nicely. Mm-hmm. You know, a big mafioso expects some respect. It's a very important part of their whole scene. You know, they always use that respect. You know, the guy didn't respect, so, you know, you have to get out some cement and drop him in the river, you know. Special overshoes like that, because they break the respect. So the things of respecting others, not expecting for yourself, that goes. So this is the Shastra. We accept that and we're intent on following it. So this is the point here. He sees through that the eyes of the scripture and he's intent on fulfilling that. So this is what the Shastra says. That is behavior. We must understand is that the behavior, the codes of laws of Manu, is all rooted in the laws of devotional service. Means devotional service is the rasa is the origin, then sadhana bhakti is its reflection, then the Vedas is in support of that. So it's all coming from one natural line. Nine. For that man who obeys the law prescribed in the revealed texts and in the sacred tradition, gains fame in this world and after death, unsurpassable bliss. So here again, the unsurpassable means, you know, devotional service. Means, but it's important that it's not by following the Dharma Shastra that gives rise to devotional service. This is a support for the devotional practice. Mm. Means the Vaishnavas are properly behaved, they're cultured. Mm. And that's because they follow the Vedic tradition. It's not that these activities, because it's understood karma, jnana, yoga can't give rise to bhakti. Bhakti is independent. But by following those in the proper attitude, we're purified. So in this way, sadhana bhakti leads to pure devotion. The sadhana bhakti is supported by the Vedic culture.
Sometimes devotees expect that devotional service, bhakti, will give rise to all good behavior, proper conduct. Mm. So I just concentrate on bhakti.
Yeah.
And automatically the proper conduct will come.
Yeah.
So then no need to endeavor separately.
Well, that's fine. It means one has to, in other words, one has to understand the full, what that means. Just like it says, one should be more tolerant than a tree, more humble than a blade of grass. So in the execution of my devotional activities, then plenty of opportunity will come up that will test my humility and my tolerance. So during those, I should be aware and maintain tolerance and humility. I don't have to separately try to become humble or separately tolerant, like by going, like the yogis will go and, you know, they'll stand up to my neck in a freezing river or in the summer, you know, out in the middle of the sun on the hottest day, put fires around me. That's what it means. There's no separate endeavor like that. Mm-hmm. In the practice of devotional service, the opportunities for applying the devotional culture, the etiquette will come, and I must take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that I can just go on being a nasty guy and do devotional service and automatically, I'm going to become wonderful. Because we have to be aware. If we actually practice, we can say, then that's one point. If we say, we can say, yes, that is true, means the scriptures say you should be like this, so be like that. You don't have to practice separately. It means in the devotional service, that is part of devotional service. You must be humble, you must be tolerant, you must respect others, you must not expect for yourself. And then the third point is it's interesting to note how it'll be, you don't have to separately endeavor for these things, but at the same time, it's somehow or another we like to separately endeavor for money, you know, for position, for influence, you know, facilities, you know, Mahaprasad. If we follow that, Mahaprasad will just come on its own. But, you know, I can make great endeavor to get it, you know, so there has to be a balance. Means that person who I don't make any endeavor for anything at all, means he doesn't make an endeavor for anything at all. Means whatever clothes, whatever food, whatever place he has to stay, he just leaves it up to Krishna. But someone who has that surrender automatically is humble. Otherwise, you can't be humble. You can't be humble and then be fighting for this and that and making politics and criticizing devotees and you know, offending people and all that. That comes out of there's some pride there, some lack of tolerance. You know, some lack of not respecting others, you know, like that. So that's why it always says devotees are special. So because we can either throw it into two. Devotees means, well, this means devotees, you know, and only a pure devotee is a devotee. And then you bring up the thing, you know, third class and second class pure devotee. No, we mean, you know, uttamadikaris and all that. Okay, one can look at it like that. Devotional service starts there. But you can also look at it from the point that someone who has come to devotional service is very special and rare. They've already done, Krishna says, they've already done all those things in their past life. Therefore, devotional service, all the things of charity, austerity, you know, all these things are already done. So then there's no, they're very rare people, you know. The Prabhupada is so powerful, he's made this rarity seem very common. And the head hurts? Means it makes it look so common, but that's his power. So, but if we get conditioned by that and then think that it's just, you know, common. But the point is we're supposed to be offering respect to all devotees, even the most new, being respectful to them, because they are devotees, and devotees is very special. Then within devotees, then there may be more respect offered as they advance, or for various services that they've done, and their realizations, and their faith, and their commitment, like that. But even just the bottom line is, they're all to be respected.
devotees are to be respected.
Ah, yes, here's a very important point. 10, this is what I was looking for. But by Shruti, revelation, is meant the Veda, and by Smriti, tradition, the institutes of the sacred law. Oh, so here's what he's meaning by the tradition here. This seems to bring a little bit more out. The tradition here, he's saying, is Smriti. In other words, the great sages have taken the Veda and then extracted from them that particular topic and established it. Like this is Manu Smriti.
Mm-hmm.
So this, or the Pancharatra, is the Smriti. Mm-hmm. In other words, anything that's come from the Veda,
mm-hmm.
that are the scriptures still, mm-hmm. then that is, that here could also be the meaning of the tradition, you know, like that. And then the virtuous conduct of those who know the Veda and the customs of holy men, that can be just like the Gaudiyas,
mm-hmm.
that kind of tradition,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then what is given in the revealed scriptures from those acharyas and that, you know, what Bhakti Lord writes, or Prabhupada mm-hmm. writes, what Bhaktisiddhanta, what they are writing. So Shruti, revelation, is meant the Veda. By Smriti, tradition, the institutes of the sacred law. So it means, yeah, okay. Those two must not be called into question in any matter, since from those two the sacred law shone forth. In other words, Shruti and Smriti can never be offended or called into question. That's the fourth offense of the holy name.
Mm-hmm.
It's the blasphemy of the Vedic literatures, the literatures in pursuance of the Vedas. So when devotees say, we don't care for that, that's breaking this rule.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fourth offense of the holy name. We may, it's true, it's a fact, but it may or may not apply to us.
Mm-hmm.
But if Prabhupada's mentioned in his books, it applies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it means Shastra cannot be called into question. You know, and this is supported by the fourth offense of the holy name. So it's from those two the sacred law shone forth. From there is all of our knowledge is shining forth. You know, it's all coming from. You have the Veda, from that is coming the Shruti, the Smriti. I mean. And that Veda then is based on the Paravidya, the transcendental, mm-hmm. the transcendence, like that. Because the essence of the Veda is the Chaturshloki, the Bhagavatam is written off of that. So the transcendental essence then is the transcendental knowledge. And then from that, the Veda is describing that, though in terms that deal with everything in the material world. We're connecting it to that Veda. But we may not be able to understand it. So then the sages have written the Smritis so that we actually get that out of the Veda. Technically, one should be able to read the four Vedas. It means before there was one Veda. And you read those Vedas, that Veda, you will know all these branches of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But since that wasn't going on, you know, nicely, especially in preparation for Kali Yuga, then Vyasadeva broke the Veda into four, and then he compiled all the Smritis, you know, and other scriptures, so that it was becomes more clear. This is history, Puranas. Mm-hmm. This is Dharma Shastra.
Mm-hmm.
This is logic. You know, this is transcendental knowledge.
Shruti means Puranas.
Shruti means the Veda. Mm-hmm. It means the Veda alone is Shruti.
Mm-hmm.
All of the scriptures are Smriti.
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
Upanishads are.
They're also Shruti. Because they're part of the Veda. The Veda has four parts. You have the Samhita, which is the verses. Then you have the Brahmanas, which tell how to apply the verses in the rituals.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the Aranyakas that describe the purpose behind them, the esoteric meanings of the rituals.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the Upanishads, which gives the philosophy of the Veda.
Mm-hmm.
So now from the Brahmanas then come the Smriti scripture of this Dharma Shastra, because that is how to apply the Veda into ritual.
Mm-hmm.
But now someone who's going to follow that ritual, who's going to perform that ritual, they have to have a particular culture.
Mm-hmm.
So they follow, means those who perform sacrifice are Aryans. Aryans follow these rules. Mm-hmm. Like that. So in other words, it's what backs up the Brahmanas, yeah, which is just practically applying the Veda in the form of ritual. Like that.
You divided the Veda into four, and usually we divide the Veda into the four Vedas. Rig, Sama, Yajur.
Yeah, yeah. Karma. Means each Veda is divided into these four parts. Uh-huh. So like that means you'd have 16 parts. Mm-hmm. Four Samhitas, four Brahmanas, four Aranyakas, and four Upanishads. Means categories, mm-hmm, in each. Then in each they have their own Brahmanas, their own Aranyakas, their own Upanishads. Like Taittiriya is connected to the Yajurveda. Mm-hmm. The Ishopanishad's Yajurveda. It's actually a very special Upanishad because it's the last chapter of the Yajurveda. All other Upanishads are not in the Samhita. Mm-hmm. They're a separate text. Mm-hmm. But the Ishopanishad is included in the last chapter of the
Yajurveda. It's really the same meter or something?
Yeah, yeah. Well, even the Upanishads are all Vedic. It's all Vedic Sanskrit with meter and everything like, mm-hmm, that. With the swaras and all that. Mm-hmm. Like that. But it's special. It's recognized by everybody because of that point. Mm-hmm. Like that. So anytime you see the list of the 10 Upanishads, Isha is always first, mm-hmm, because of that position. Mm-hmm. Then I think what Mundaka is the Samaveda.
Chandogya is Rig.
Chandogya is Rig. Like this. You know, they have, that's their main ones. And then they have so many others like this. The 108 are all, mm-hmm, connected with the Vedas. Mm-hmm. Then 11. Every twice born man who, relying on the institutes of dialectics, treats with contempt those two sources of the law, must be cast out by the virtuous as an atheist and a scorner of the Veda. In other words, anyone who is dialectics, what is dialectics? Relying on the aesthetic institutes of reasoning. Ah, okay. Oh, in other words, someone whose their methods of reasoning is against the Vedas doesn't respect the Shruti and the Smriti, then those who are virtuous must cast them out of their association. In other words, don't associate with someone who does not accept the authority of the Vedas and the Vedic literatures. You know, we may approach them and view them. I mean, we do approach them and view them through our acharyas. Mm. But the point is we do accept the Veda and we do accept the Shrutis. Mm. They, in some situations, some rules may or may not apply to us, but they're bona fide. Mm-hmm. You know, they're bona fide. It's just a matter of how they can never be spoken against. You know. And for us, then the Bhagavatam becomes more important than the Vedas, like that. That's that Jiva Goswami, then his Tattva Sandarbha establishes that point. More important than the Vedas are the Puranas in the Kali Yuga. And of the Puranas, then the Bhagavatam is the most important. So therefore, it becomes the most important of all the scriptures.
And that's because the Purana tells us how to follow the Veda?
Tells us how to follow, yeah.
And then of the Puranas, only the Bhagavatam is available in its entirety?
Not so much that, it's because the Bhagavatam actually deals just with transcendental application, while the others are aimed kind of at application of the mode of goodness and the mode of passion, the mode of ignorance. Mm-hmm. In other words, you take the law of the Veda, means, mm-hmm, or the how you say it, the science of the Vedas, and you apply it according to the mode of goodness or according to the mode of passion or mode of ignorance. That's why it said it's written for those people. Mm. The Skanda Puran is not in the mode of ignorance. It's written in a language that attracts, and its application is it attracts those in the mode of ignorance. Mm-hmm. Though within it will always be contained still what is the actual transcendental position, though, mm-hmm, it's hidden. Mm-hmm. You know, like in the Mahabharata, 100,000 verses, cloaked within that is the Bhagavad Gita. Mm-hmm. 700 verses. Mm-hmm. Like that. So the idea is that someone is very happy to read the whole Mahabharata and all the juicy bits in there, and then these ones they'll get from there. Maybe they'll just kind of tolerate and read through it, or maybe they'll actually get some benefits. So someone's motivated to read, you know, the Skanda Puran, Linga Puran, and all these because of its flavor for someone in the mode of ignorance. But then by reading it, if they're intelligent or fortunate, they come across those verses that tell that this process of doing things in the mode of ignorance is not up to snuff, and it actually should be a transcendental platform. Then they may take that and elevate themselves. Otherwise, then they'll just go on in their ignorance and miss. But the Bhagavatam is presented just from the platform of pure transcendence. That's why it says the Kaitava Dharma is thrown out.
In the first verse.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, is the last verse of Gita means every scripture has its invocation and its phala shruti.
Mm-hmm.
Means it's what are the benefits of reading it. So means the last verse basically of the Gita is Sarvadharma Parityaja. After this, then Krishna starts describing who's qualified to hear it and what is the results of hearing it.
Mm.
And then Sanjay also then puts in the results. So that's like the phala shruti. So last verse is Sarvadharma Parityaja. And then after the invocation, the first verse of Bhagavatam is, you know, this, what is it? Yes, yeah, how's it called? Dharma Kaitava. Yeah. So it means it's starting out with the same thing. You know, so that's what Prabhupada says, very natural. The Gita is the first study and the Bhagavatam is the next study. The verse that Gita ends on, that's the verse that Bhagavatam starts from. You know, like that. But now Bhagavatam will give example of those persons that have thrown out mundane religion and are following the Sanatana Dharma.
Mm.
You know? Like that. Arjuna was quoting Kaitava Dharma because he's protecting, you know, the family and the traditions, but not for the purpose of pleasing the Lord. So that's Kaitava Dharma.
Mm.
That's cheating religion. But in the Bhagavatam, then all that's been thrown out. Whatever you see here is how people followed Dharma to please the Lord, and how wonderful things went. And those who didn't do it, what happened to them? You know, like Hiranyakashipu or that. He followed Dharma, but not, you know, just to please himself. You know, and even, you know, twisted the Dharma and perverted the Dharma.
I think the final verse of the Bhagavatam mentions Sankirtan.
Oh. Uh-huh, and then that gives rise to the Chaitanya Charitam. That's far out.
Should be investigated. I think somehow that's in my mind.
That would be good. Yeah, we'll have to look that up.
Yeah,
yeah, score. Look that up. See? Yeah. So in there, it's very... That's far out. Confirm. The Veda, the sacred tradition, the customs of virtuous men, and one's own pleasure, they declare to be visibly the fourfold means of defining the sacred law. Okay, this we went through before. So here again, one's own pleasure, one's own satisfaction means defining the sacred law. Means the Veda has explained it, then the sacred tradition of the Smritis have given the, you know, extracted it and given it to us, you know, very clearly.
Mm.
Then the customs of virtuous men, means the previous acharyas and all the great devotees. And then one's own pleasure means I apply it how it applies in my life, because I have 8 options of varnas and ashrams, so I have to be able to find what fits, like that. That is that's how the sacred law is defined. In other words, there's the theory and there's the practical. So the theory is the Veda. Then giving more clearly the theory is the Smriti. Then the virtuous men show the application, and then I have to see how it applies to me. Mm. So I follow, you know, that particular person. You know, do I follow Prithu Maharaj, or do I follow Kolibetra Sridhar, or do I follow, you know, Sudama Brahmana, or, you know, it's like this. Is that what fits like that? Is that?
It's like another, like we have the Guru Sadhu Shastra as a formula.
Hmm.
This is like another formula.
It's same. You say sadhu means guru, sadhu, shastra. Shastra, then it's giving two here, the Veda and the Smriti. And then sadhu, then here it's mentioning that will be the virtuous men. And then and guru, and the virtuous men is guru and sadhu. Means there's two definitions here, it gives one. And then one's own pleasure. Means how you'll apply it. It's similar. So you always see it's the principles are always the same, just where they emphasize more or less. Because this is showing the source of the thing. So then it goes into detail of the scriptures like that. And then it's not getting into so much the detail of the sort, you know, how you say? At this point of the interaction. That'll get into later. So it just gives, it doesn't divide the virtuous person into guru and sadhu. Like that.
Yeah, also it's giving authenticity to itself.
Yeah.
Because it starts Veda. And then coming from the Veda we have this Shruti.
Smriti.
And this is Smriti.
Yeah.
So then it's like, this is the source, this is what we are.
Very good. And then the previous chapter, then it showed that Veda then was heard from Krishna. So you have Krishna, then Shruti, the Veda, then Smriti, this Dharma Shastra. Then we will gain it. Means here we're taking right from here. We're hearing it from Bhrigu, who will be a virtuous person. Like that. So that would be probably another reason why he would be speaking it rather than Manu. Because it means he has taken it, understood it, now he's speaking. Then for us, is our main source of this law will be through Prabhupada's books and what the Acharya has given us. Because they deal with this already. They've already dealt with it. We're just taking from here to just basically understand that what is discussed here, Prabhupada's. So it means whatever we've discussed up to now, nothing's new to us. It's just a matter of like solidifying. Means what culture and everything Prabhupada talks about. It's like you have the Veda, and then from the Veda you get the Smriti.
Specialized.
So from Prabhupada's books, then we're just taking out a study of Prabhupada's books in this way, like that. Okay, another two verses and stuff. The knowledge of the sacred law is prescribed for those who are not given to the acquisition of wealth and to the gratification of their desires. To those who seek the knowledge of the sacred law, the supreme authority is the revelation, Shruti. So the sacred law is for those who are not interested in wealth and sense gratification. It means if that's their main interest, the sacred law is you know, they're supposed to follow it, but they may or may not, like that. So in other words, it's for those who may have wealth, senses will always be dealt with, but it's not for those who are making that the life of the soul. And for those such persons who are not interested in wealth and gratifying the senses, then the knowledge that comes from the Veda, that is important to them. So the supreme authority is the Veda, like that. So we always accept that. Is the Veda. Prabhupada always talks about the Vedas, because the Veda has said it. Sometimes devotees have a tendency to avoid this. You know, it's like, well, Prabhupada didn't, like that. But Prabhupada's, you know, you say Vedic culture, and they'll say, well, what do you mean by Vedic culture? That's not what Prabhupada talks about, it's not Vedic culture. What Prabhupada talks about, that is Vedic culture. Then there are other aspects, that's the pure Vedic culture. Then there's other aspects of the Vedic culture for more materialistic people. That we're leaving. We're taking the essence, you know. You know, it would be like Prabhupada is giving us ghee, you know. And then someone mentions about milk, and they say, "Oh, we don't care about milk," like that. No, that's not, you know. You know, if we say where we mention ghee is, you know, in relationship to milk, and they'll say, "No, has nothing to do with it." Point is it's just that is the essence of it. that Prabhupada's given us is the essence of the culture. So it is Vedic culture, and Prabhupada always called it Vedic culture, and he always uses the term Vedic culture.
Much to the
chagrin.
Yeah, of scholars even.
Yeah.
How can you call it Vedic? It's Vedic is the rituals of the Samaveda.
Yeah, because they don't understand. The Vedic, the essence is always remember Krishna, never forget. That's a Vedic principle. You know, Lord Chaitanya says that the essence of the knowledge of the Veda, Veda is only describing three things, sambandha, abhede, and prayojana. So, Krishna says there's only one path. So on that path of abhideya, then he has all his prescribed duties of karma. That someone who wants to go through the slow path goes through all those details of that. Then he gives so many details on jnana, and one goes through all of that, and so many on yoga, and he goes through all of that. That someone who's interested in the fast path just takes the essence out of karma, jnana, and yoga, and uses that in Krishna's service. That's nishkam karma yoga. And then very quickly becomes purified. So that's the fast path that Krishna is talking about. That's the sadhana bhakti. So in that are going to be the rules that are flat, because it's all Krishna's path. There isn't another path. So if one says, oh, that's not this path, means one doesn't understand the path. You know, then we're agreeing with, what is his name? Vivekananda. Jato mat tato pat. You know, however many philosophies there are, there's that many paths. There's only one path. Just where on the path and how much detail you want to get into that you want to get slow.
Which direction you're going.
Yeah, in which direction you're going, towards or away. So you have to be very clear. It means their purpose is the how you say, the purpose is laudable in that statement, meaning that they want to stick very closely to Prabhupada's instructions and not become distracted. But they have to understand that what is Prabhupada's level of understanding and realization, what he is empowered to do. Means he's gone through. Means we take the Goswamis, Nana Shastra Vichara Naika Nipano. They've gone through the scriptures. Means Gopal Bhatta Goswami is quoting from, you know, Skanda Puran and Linga Puran in his introduction to Sakriya Sardipika. That means he's read it. You know? And he's gone through that and pulled out these verses. Sanatana Goswami's pulled out all the verses in his books. Then you see in Nectar Devotion, you know, Vishnu Yamala and this one and that one, you know. He's quoting Vedic literatures. So they've taken that connection to the Vedic literature, taken the essence from that and presented it in Nectar Devotion, Hari Bhakti Vilas, Sakriya Saradipika. And this is our body of our Dharma Shastra, basically. Right? And then you know, but this is the higher principles of it. You know, and the ritual of it, and then the whole social thing, then that is just, it's already here. Why you have to bother? You know? If someone's already written a great math book, you know, I may write a book on quantum mechanics. But when my students want to come up to the level of quantum mechanics, they have to learn arithmetic first. I'll just refer to that other book. Why I have to write a new book? It's already there. Like that. That's been done. But to understand higher principles, that may not be understandable by the common mathematician. So therefore, that aspect is written. So the Dharma Shastras and just how a husband and wife relate to each other and live with each other without killing each other. That, I mean, Manu has dealt with so nicely. What, you don't have to worry about it, you know. And Prabhupada has already taken out of Manu Smriti and Yajnavalkya and Parasara, he quotes these three, and given that to us. Like that. So that's done. Then the higher principle is how to understand how to use that in Krishna's service. That's the important thing. You know?
Sampat Kumar Bhattacharya? When you were speaking with him, he said, he told that story of that devotee that went to get the brands.
I don't remember.
Some devotees came to him and said, you know, we've read somewhere that we have to get the...
Shankar Chakra, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, please. Oh, no, Prabhupada has already given you everything. He says, no, we have to have this. So it's like a few days ritual. all the ceremonies involved. Uh-huh. And finally the culmination is, it's like an initiation into the Sri Sampradaya. Uh-huh. Culmination is the branding.
Uh-huh.
And then he then he's taken under the cloth and given the mantra, Sarvanama Prityagya, and then some specific instruction. So he did all of that. And then he gave the instruction, he gave the mantra, Sarvanama Prityagya, and then he gave a specific instruction. He said, Prabhupada has already given you everything. Only he can save you.
Yeah, that's true.
And then he said that Prabhupada has taken the Prabhupada has taken the fruit and taken off the skin and cut it nicely and taken out the seeds and put it on a plate and given to his disciples. But some disciples, they come back and they want the
seeds left in the field.
The seeds and the skin.
Yeah, he said like that. That's fine.
It's like we were saying about the ghee.
Yeah.
It's come from milk.
And it's already come. So you call it, this is the Vedic culture. So what Prabhupada talks about, that is Vedic culture. It's just like Vedic culture, the four regulative principles. You know? So Prabhupada mentions Kshatriyas can eat meat if they're not interested to go back to Godhead. If they want to go back to Godhead, then they themselves must follow also. You know? King can have more than one wife, but if he's serious about spiritual life, he'll only stick to one. You know, Ram showed that, only one wife. Like that we see in Muchukunda, because he went out and hunting and killing the animals, and then Krishna, in the deliverance of Muchukunda, told him next life he would take birth as a Brahmin, and he specifically mentioned, because as a Kshatriya you've killed all these animals and all that. So one more birth as a Brahmin, and then you'll go back to Godhead. So it's like, so the essence is that. So the others we don't take. It's like the Mahabharata gives another story of a different yuga of the manifestation of Parikit and you know, and this being bitten by the snake. You know, as a king he built a palace and tried to hide in there, and Takshaka had to come in, you know, on an apple and you know, and all this kind of thing. But that's the essence is Parikit acting as a Paramahamsa. Which is in the Bhagavatam. Like that. I mean, every Kali Yuga, this pastime of Parikit and the Bhagavatam being spoken and all that's going on. So the Mahabharata gives, if we just say he's pure devotee, just sits there in meditation and all that, it's not so juicy. Right? Like that. But you say that he built a palace, this and that, then every, more, you know, more people can relate to it. You know, yeah, if I was in that situation, I'd build a palace, I'd do this and that, and, you know, so many different things. So the essence of it is the Bhagavatam. So there's so many things there in the Vedic culture, you know, what you can do. But that's all for people who are more materialistic. But if you want to go back to God here, which is the purpose, always remember Krishna, never forget, that's the actual purpose of the Veda. So one who follows that is actually a practitioner of the Vedic literature, is actually. So those who are followers of basically the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, it means any Vaishnav. Vaishnavas, practicing Sampradayic Vaishnavas, are actually the real followers of the Vedic culture, not the Smartas and all these others. They're the real followers. You know, and in this age, then especially those who are followers of Lord Chaitanya, they are like the best of those who are following the Vedic culture. So it's just a matter of how you define the terms.
Tadasandava Jiva Goswami gives the 10 ways of acquiring knowledge, Madhacharya quotes. The first 7 he discloses on the first thing.
Discards.
Yes, this is the uselessness. And he says this Pratyaksha Anuman and Shabda left. The Pratyaksha Anuman is not perfect because Pratyaksha you gain things by your imperfect senses. Anuman you base your logic and your deduction on the knowledge that you get with your imperfect senses. So it's also not perfect. The only perfect thing is Vedic knowledge. And then he starts quoting from the Vedas. That's why Vedic knowledge is perfect. Then he himself says, now if I say this, then other pandits will say this is circular reasoning. The Vedas say the Veda is most perfect. said, but if I want to see the sun, I cannot make big enough fire to get to see the sun. The sun can only be seen if he comes up, then he gives his own effulgence and you can see the sun. It's not circular reasoning. He said, if you want to see the top of the highest building, you have to be standing on top of the highest building, because you don't see the top of the highest building. So then he just goes, yes, so Vedic knowledge is the highest, and it's stated in the Vedas.
Yes. That's good. That's good.
Now, this is important. This is very important here. This is what really blows the scholars out. Text 14. Text 14. But when two sacred texts, Shruti, are conflicting, both are held to be law, for both are pronounced by the wise to be valid law. And he gives an example. Thus the Agnihotra sacrifice may be optionally performed at any time after the sun has risen, before he has risen, or when neither sun nor stars are visible. That is declared by Vedic texts. In other words, if the texts give different ways of doing it, they're all right. It means you can follow any one of them. Therefore, we must have the example of the virtuous persons. In other words, our acharyas. Because there's so many ways it can be done. You know, I mean, you want to cook a sabji, you can cook it in hundreds of ways. So then you can say, yes, this way of cooking it, this is, you know, or these ways of cooking it, this is Gujarati, this is Bengali, this is South Indian, you know, this is, you know, your whatever, like this. So it's correct. And it's just what our line accepts. Because here it's saying, he's giving the example. In other words, one text says that you perform the Agnihotra after the sun has risen. Means when you can see the sun, means at that point in the Sunday, you know, because within that muhurta, then the another text says it should be before it is risen. Means it's still, the stars are in the sky, it's still dark, like that. And then another text says that before the sun has risen, and after the stars are not visible. In other words, it's not arunodoy, ushodoy. Means the light of the sun is up, but the sun itself is not up. So one is saying arunodoy, one is saying ushodoy, one is saying suryodoy. Like that. So any of them are proper. You know? So if it's, you don't have a specific thing that you must do it at this point, then you can follow any of those. Like that. But none of them are wrong. They're all bona fide. But if in your particular tradition, you know, your acharyas then always perform it this time, then it's best at that time. Like that. And then you'll take the others as secondary. Like that. If you can't do it at that, okay, then we'll do it at this. Like if you can't do it while the stars are still in the sky, okay, then we should do it, you know, at the ushodoy, between. And if you can't do that, okay, then once the sun's already come up. Like that. You know, while others it may be, it's done after the sun comes up, because before that they want you to do something else. You know? So you don't, means we want you to do Mangalartik. And after Mangalartik, then you can do your yajna. Otherwise they don't, then someone will go, oh, the texts say it should be done before that, so instead of Mangalartik they'll be doing this. You know? Just like the practice of musical instruments. If that means if you go to a music gurukul, that when we're doing Mangalartik, that's when they're playing on their musical instruments and practicing the music. Because whatever you do at that time of the day, you get the best results. So they're into music, so they do that at that time. We're into going back to Godhead, so we have Mangalartik. So for us, then we'll say, you know, they'll say, you know, you should practice your music at this time, or, you know, in the early morning, either before a sun or after. It says it's all, early morning is good. So then we will take that the after, you know, the sun is up, you know, that kind of later. Means after we've chanted, we've Mangalartik, we've chanted a japa, like this. Then if you want to do something early in the morning, okay, then you spend a little time. But it's like that we'll do. Or if there's another time, evening, then we'll take that, you know, because we want to use the whole morning for our morning program. But the idea is according to what is important for you, then you will take those scriptures. But here is meaning the point is, because it's contradictory, seemingly contradictory doesn't mean that any of them are wrong. They're all right, as long as they're bona fide scripture. Okay, so then we'll let's do some other questions, and we'll stop here, because now it gets into who is qualified to learn this, what is an Aryan, and all that, and like that. Any other points? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.